is 1460, and England is on the verge of a third civil war in a decade. On one side, you have the legitimate government and the regime of King Henry VI, King of England, and also the sufferer of severe mental illness. And on the other side, you have his cousin, Edward, the Duke of York, and also a, well, full-time political agitator about now. The king's regime, led by his wife, the French-born Queen Margaret of Anjou, had thought they had achieved final victory after the Second Civil War. The last time fighting had broken out in England, they had driven the Duke of York and his allies out of the country, into exile, and then used legal methods to destroy their political foes. However, time brought about what seemed to be a third war, and that was due to break out any minute now. The aim of my podcast has been to ask which side was London on, but in truth it has to be said that most folks in the city didn't have a side they wanted to pick. This was a fight between nobles, none of whom had a particularly big influence in London. The average person living in London, working within its walls and along its streets, arguably would have not really cared too much about which lord was insulting which other lord. But they would have cared about the city's politics and the city's fortunes. And that meant, well, while London did not have noble lords to be loyal to, they did have livery companies to be loyal to and the masters of those livery companies. Bottom line, in the complex, multifaceted streets of our city, there were many opinions, many reasons to pick a side, and many facets of support for both sides. But the livery companies within the town itself were becoming more and more pro-Yorkist. Sure, as we've covered, there was a small cabal within the grocers' company who had long been open advocates for the Duke of York, but more and more, it does seem to be the Crown's policies towards the city that was pushing London towards the exiled Yorkist nobles. But even with that said, fundamentally, I honestly believe that the normal, average citizens of London did not really feel strongly one way or another. Nor would they, unless, you know, somebody did something really stupid like, you know, use napalm on the streets of London, indiscriminately killing men, women and children. I mean, yeah, sure, something like that would change the opinion of the city's residents. Anyway, this episode is that one time in 1460 when somebody used napalm on the streets of London, indiscriminately killing men, women and children. Yeah, seriously. Hi there, my name is Saul and you are listening to The Story of London, the podcast that tries to tell the chronological history of this metropolis, meandering through time as quickly as we can, but, you know, stopping off to stare at the cool things along the way. And 1460, as you may be able to tell, turned out to be one hell of an interesting year. So let's stop here for a while and have a look at what happened and explore the fourth part of the story of the City of London during the War of the Roses. Welcome then to chapter 165 of this story. The danger is imminent. So, in 1460, there's a lot going on that we have to cover, and it's all happening simultaneously. I mean, before this episode starts, don't forget, the Duke of Somerset has invaded France, and he's trying to take Calais, and he's going to lose. But we're going to start in London with a moment of absolute paranoia. You see, the royal court was not dumb. It could tell London's mercantile classes were moving towards the Yorkists, and there was a growing apprehension that there might be secret communications going on between the Duke of York supporters in London and the nobles who were in exile in Calais. This appears to have driven the sudden arrest and imprisonment in the Tower of London in February of 1460 of the pro-Yorkist lawyer, advocate and honorary member of the Grocers' Company, Thomas Young, thrown into the Tower on suspicion of treason. Now, there was no evidence that he was writing to the Earl of Warwick over in Calais, and he was eventually allowed to be bailed. And the bail was paid for by his brother, John Young, the prominent grocer William Venner, and Alderman Philip Malpras, and amounted to a cool £1,000. Malpras, like Venner and Young, was an avowed Yorkist, and it's fair to say these are the supporters of the Duke of York in London bailing out one of their own. The Crown was watching London suspiciously. Hostility was growing as well as paranoia. But in truth, to be fair to the Royal Court, they did have good reason to be paranoid, because the losers of the last civil war were clearly planning a new one. In March of 1460, the Earl of Warwick and his ships from the piratical Calais garrison managed to sail along the entire coast of southern England and Wales with nobody bothering them, and hold a conference with the Duke of York in Waterford in the south coast of Ireland. Here the two rebel camps had the time and space to sit, discuss, and plan their next stage. They had lost the last war, they'd been driven out of England. It was now time to return to England. It was now time for an invasion. And it would begin with propaganda. The Yorkists sent ahead of any invasion force many copies of their now customary political manifestos, which protested their absolute loyalty to the king and repeated their usual battle cries: there was no justice to be found in England anymore. And the king's household failed to, quote, live upon its own livelihood, unquote. In other words, the king should be able to live on the money he gets from his private estates rather than needing public taxation to pay for him. These manifestos in the 1460s also added an accusation that ever since Humphrey, the Duke of Gloucester, had been murdered at Bury in 1447, something we covered all the way back in chapter 158, that elements within the royal government were deliberately trying to wipe out the Duke of York and his entire branch of the royal dynasty. See, this propaganda campaign was very smart and very deliberate. The supporters of the Duke of York could see that the Crown's more popular regions of support were the Midlands, Wales, and up in the northwest of England. Hence, the Yorkists made sure this kind of material went around places like Kent or the southeast, the places where Jack Cade got his following from in his rebellion, which took place only 10 years and 5 chapters ago. That rumble of dissatisfaction that had led Kent and the southeast into open rebellion back then had never been totally silenced and could be rekindled easily by these kind of rabble-rousing publications. But manifestos do not win wars. Violence was needed, and the exiles followed up on their campaign of propaganda by the Earl of Salisbury's brother, Lord Fauconberg, suddenly storming the defences of the port of Sandwich on the 25th of June 1460, seizing the town's weapon store, the harbour, and then capturing and beheading the unlucky royal captain, Osbert Mudford. A new war had started, and the first bloke was struck in Sandwich on the southeast coast of England. And then the following day, June 26, the Earl of Warwick, the Earl of March, and the Earl of Salisbury landed at Sandwich with a force bristling with the piratical stormtroopers of the garrison of Calais. The new invasion force centred themselves for a few days and then marched north, straight towards London. For such a horrendous year in the history of our city, there is actually comparatively little written about the events of July 1460. As such, what follows is me trying to reconstruct the sequence of moments from a myriad of other historians. All of them mention these events, but from their own filter of expertise. So this is me once again putting events into sequence and also trying to present it in a way that is narratively entertaining. Okay, with that warning in mind. Towards the end of June 1460, the army of the rebellious earls was now marching north from Sandwich towards Gravesend and eventually aiming for London. Now, there can be almost no doubt that the merchants of the stapler faction of London, the wool merchants within the ranks of the Mercers and Grocers Company of the city, they knew in advance that this invasion was coming. Indeed, it is highly probable that these Londoners had helped pay for the invasion, to be honest. So as the army marched towards the city, we can say with almost utter certainty that there was a powerful pro-Yorkist faction in London awaiting their arrival. But London was far from united in the Yorkist cause, as we've said, and agitation to resist the invasion began almost at once. Before the army even came close, one of the resident nobles of the city, a man called John Lovell, together with other pro-royal lords, such as the Earl of Kendal, Lord Scales and Lord Hungerford, went to London's Guildhall to try to convince the city's aldermen and general population to hold out against the invaders. Their appeal seemed to work. As the Yorkists marched towards the city, a group within the city walls demanded that cannon be placed at the south end of London Bridge to keep the rebels out. 12 of the city's aldermen, however, took an altogether different view, and things were in flux. The fundamental truth was no one side had total advantage within the city. All knew that this new war would be determined on the battlefield. That, as such, it could go either way. There was huge political uncertainty, and these political uncertainties were actually damaging the city's trade and financial confidence. The rents collected from properties owned by the Mercers and Grocers Company in that year were less than half the normal amounts they would gather. And the grocers had cut the cut back on spending again. Once again, their election feast had been reduced to a election supper. And there now follows some confusion. The mayor of London was supposedly a fishmonger called William Heylin, but records of him are scattered. Indeed, as far as I can tell, there's only one document that names him as mayor at this crucial moment, and I'll come to that. But whatever the case, it fell to William Heylin to navigate the city through the arrival of the Earl of Warwick and his Yorkist supporting troops. And it was Mayor Heylin who ultimately decided that London would not side with the Queen and not give battle here in Southwark to the Earl of Warwick and his men. London decided not to place cannon to greet the invaders. Rather, the city sent letters asking assurances that Warwick soldiers would be working under military discipline, not turning up to loot the city, and if that was the case, they would open its gates to Warwick's forces. At this, at the obvious approach of the Yorkists, those pro-royal nobles in the city, who included Lord Hungerford, Lovell, Lord de Vestry, and the Earl of Kendal, they all panicked. They and their families and the wife of the Duke of Exeter there and then decided to flee and take refuge in the Tower of London. Technically, the Duke of Exeter was acting Constable of the Tower right now, but as he held several other offices and was absent from the city, the Tower was actually held at the time by a noble veteran of the French Wars, Lord Scales. On the 2nd of July, after the Yorkist lords had given assurances of their troops' behaviour, the city's gates were indeed thrown open to them. And as they proceeded to march across London Bridge, however, alas, crowds rushed forward to get a sight of them, and two men were trampled to death. Not a great start. The Yorkist soldiers were apparently temporarily billeted up in Smithfield, and as such, that meant they would have marched in procession through London, and all the residents, both Royalist and Yorkist alike, would have seen this force come en masse. And it was here the city discovered a very high-profile acolyte of the Yorkist faction had come with this army, the Bishop of Terni in central Italy, a man called Francesco Coppini. Now, Coppini had been appointed as a papal legate to visit the realm of Henry VI, with a mandate to get the King of England to commit forces to a crusade against the Turks. And yes, crusading was still a thing. And the bishop, on orders from the Pope, had dutifully trotted off north and got as far as Calais. And when he got to Calais, he met the very cool, very, very sexy Earl of Warwick. And the Earl of Warwick had beguiled the living socks of him. And so now here he was, turning up in London, nothing less than a high-ranking priestly cheerleader of the cause of the Duke of York and his people. And while in London, the Earl of Warwick used him well. Coppini published at St. Paul's a very colourful open letter to King Henry VI. In it, the papal legate said that the Duke and his supporters were all loyal to the king, and he damned their enemies as, quote, clerks and ministers of the devil, unquote. There on the door of St. Paul's Cathedral, the words of the papal legate himself were seen by all, warning the king he was doomed, and claiming it would be, quote, the danger and ruin of your state, unquote, if he failed to come to terms with Warwick and his stupid, sexy pirates of Calais and all his allies. And above all, that those that, quote, close their ears like deaf vipers, woe to them and also to you, your majesty. The danger is imminent and does not brook delay, unquote. With the words of the representatives of the Pope being spoken off across the city, right now, trapped in the tower, witnessing all of this, the royalist nobles would have watched with a sense of horror. Under the command of Lord Scales, their numbers were growing, and one account of the time records that within the walls were, quote, Lord Vesey, Lord Lovell, Lord Delaware, Lord Kendall of Gascony, Sir Edmund Hampton, Knight, Sir Thomas Brown, Knight, Sheriff of Kent, John Brunion of Kent, Sir Gervase Clifton, Knight, Treasurer of the King's House, Sir Thomas Tyrrell, Knight, the Duchess of Exeter, and many more, unquote. Now, I will come back to one of those names, Sir Thomas Brown, Knight and Sheriff of Kent. His story is slightly important. But the royalists in the tower, while watching the Yorkists take over, would have been horrific. They were also safe. The Tower of London was fairly well defended and pretty well supplied. As well as that, and above all, they had river access. And the residents of the tower could well have imagined that they could sail out to get supplies even if the Yorkists held the town. Meanwhile, the Yorkist leaders themselves decided to only hang around in London for 48 hours before drawing up their forces into two large divisions. The first was led by Lord Falkenberg and the second headed by the Earl of Warwick himself. Forces organised and armies arranged. They set off north quickly to confront the king, but they left behind Richard Neville, the Earl of Salisbury, the wily head of that entire dynasty. And it's recorded in accounts of the time that, quote, the Earl of Salisbury, by common consent of the city, was made ruler and governor of London, unquote. Salisbury took one look at the situation in the city, and, well, he didn't see the Tower of London as anything special. It was just a castle, and it had to be besieged. In this, Richard Neville was supported by a man called Lord Wenlock. He'd stayed in the city as well to help Salisbury, and it was Wenlock who organised the blockade on the river, galvanising London's rivermen, and therefore Salisbury could besiege the fortress, as a chronicle put it, quote, by land and by water, unquote. The tower was now fully cut off, the boatmen of London joining in the siege. Meanwhile, a few last holdouts of the royalist faction in the city realised they had to make an attempt to get into the tower before the blockade was fully in place, and this included the pro-royalist grocer Thomas Brown. He had remained staunchly loyal to the royalist cause since he was given the post of Sheriff of Kent. As Sheriff of Kent, however, he'd taken one look at the invading forces and decided to regroup in London, where he had his own circle of friends and business associates associated with his time as a grocer. He was also probably aware that it was probably too late for him to make his peace with the pro-royalists' opponents, as many of the pro-royal merchants like William Pesce were doing. And as such, with a few like-minded associates, Thomas Brown violently broke the blockade of the tower by the Yorkist forces and joined the defenders inside. Salisbury increased the numbers blockading it, and suddenly the July 1460 siege of the Tower of London had begun. And it escalated hard. Lord Scales immediately ordered that the cannon should open fire from the tower, indiscriminately firing into the surrounding streets. A contemporary chronicle at the time related that, quote, they that were within the tower cast wildfire into the city and shot in small guns and burned and hurt men and women and children in the street, unquote. Yep, this went hard and dark real fast. The tower is firing its small cannon into the houses nearby indiscriminately and also using wildfire, some kind of chemical agent, the 15th century version of napalm. This is not a gentle standoff. This is a siege where things are immediately nasty and close. The Earl of Salisbury had been left about 2,000 men to besiege the Tower of London, but quickly to this was now added a large militia raised from the rather infuriated citizens of London. The bastards in the Tower were firing cannon at them. They're shooting at their kids. They're burning down their homes. These guys. It's worth remembering that any reasonably affluent male person of the city owned at least a padded leather jacket and armour, and some could afford full plate armour. Many had swords and daggers and bows and clubs, and many had long bills. And several of these men were veterans of the red and white dressed watchmen who patrolled London under the reign of Mayor Boleyn, which we covered a couple of chapters ago, and they knew these streets, and they knew how to take care of themselves. And if those bastards in the Tower of London wanted to fight, all right, sweethearts, fine. It was said it was the Common Council of London who requisitioned other cannons and bombards from around London to be pressed into service off the city. Long-term listeners would know that London had long been a place where cannons were stored, sometimes even in the Guildhall itself. The city handed these cannons over to the Earl of Salisbury, and he placed them across the river on the south bank, facing the Tower of London. And then he ordered them to open fire. So now we have artillery over in Southwark and Bermondsey firing across the River Thames into the Tower of London, and the tower firing back and also around the town, and also using what sounds like napalm upon the citizens. Shit's gone south real fast here, people. The artillery barrage against the tower worked. Part of the southern curtain wall was brought down. Meanwhile, the siege stepped up elsewhere. On the city side, Lord Cobham was placed in charge of the soldiers and citizens attacking the walls from that side. And over on the other side around St. Catherine's Church, Sir John Wenlock was supported by the mercer John Harrow and maintained the siege on that side. And by all accounts, there were continuous clashes and conflicts. Arrows were fired, small guns were fired, cannons were fired, sallies were launched. At one stage, apparently, Lord Scales and the nobles inside the town sent a letter to the city's council, demanding to know why the council was making war upon them. It's a remarkable read. What follows is a translation into modern English. It's not entirely correct, but it's as close as we can get it. Quote, "Sirs, it is you who are saying that you are the king's true liegemen, and so are we. Wherefore, we will desire of you to write the cause of why you make us war, and that we may understand how you may join your sayings and your deeds together, and also what should be the cause why you take prisoners, and we should not defend us against you. And of this above, said we pray of you an answer, for we cast us no more to encumber you with our writing," unquote. Why are you attacking us? What have we done? The London Common Council's reply to the nobles in the tower, quote, "Like it your lordships to understand, and with for certain, that according to our saying, we have been, now we are, and ever will be the king's true subjects and humble liegemen. And where you by your bill desire us to write the cause of why we make you war, etc. Therefore we answer and say that you and your fellowship have begun and made war by diverse assaults, shooting of guns, and otherwise by which the king's true liege people, as well as the inhabitants of this city, men, women, and children, have been murdered, maimed, slain, and mischieved in sundry wise. And so that has been done by us is only on your occasion in our defence.
As such, we take prisoner Bean for the attempted occasions and assaults done by them as aforesaid in breach of the king's peace, and for despoiling of the king's true people of their vitals and goods without due contract or payment. Unquote. And for a week, this was London. The siege of the Tower dominated life. Indiscriminate fighting, sniping, and more. We can tell from the letters that some of the loyalist nobles or their families or their supporters had been taken prisoner and were being held hostage. This was everything to the city, and it only changed because of events going on elsewhere in England. By the 7th of July, the sheer alacrity of the Yorkist two columns reaching the Midlands took the royal court at Coventry completely by surprise. King Henry and Queen Margaret had no choice but to go out and meet the rebels. But they were unorganised, clearly rattled, and very much under strength. There was no time for Henry, the Earl of Northumberland, or John, Lord Clifford, to reach the royal army with their men. And while the king and queen were attended by numerous great lords, like Humphrey, the Duke of Buckingham, the Earl of Shrewsbury, Viscount Beaumont, and a healthy smattering of the Percy clan, the Yorkists had managed to attract far more noble support now than they had at any previous time when they'd taken to the field. The Yorkists were also accompanied by a large group of the most important churchmen in England, alongside Thomas Butcher, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and the papal legate Coppenini, with the bishops of Exeter, Lincoln, Salisbury, Ely, Rochester, and Thomas Kempe, the Bishop of London. The two sides finally met on the 10th of July in a meadow outside of Northampton on the south bank of the River Nene. It was, by all accounts, a utterly miserable day, with the rain pounding from the sky since the sun had risen, as thousands of men and horses marched towards what was to become a battle scene. Their feet trudged the waterlogged soil to mud quickly. And for the royal side, this rain also rendered useless their many cannon. Despite these very unfavourable conditions, the commander of the royal forces, the Duke of Buckingham, refused to negotiate with Warwick. He lined up his men between a slight bend in the river and a nearby abbey and prepared to give battle. The bishops over in Warwick's side retreated a safe distance so they could watch. The royalist army was divided into three battalions, Buckingham leading the left flank, the Earl of Shrewsbury and the Earl of Beaumont in the centre, and Lord Grey of Rathlin on the right side. But no sooner had the battle supposedly started than Lord Grey decided to defect, bringing his men over to the Yorkist side, where Falkenberg, Warwick and March were in charge of their troops. The result was total confusion amongst the king's men. Battered by the rain, they completely abandoned any discipline, and soldiers began to desert there and then, running for Northampton, several drowning in the River Nene under the weight of their provisions and armour. And as panic and chaos descended, Warwick's men followed the ruthless tactics that had served them well 6 years before in the Battle of St. Albans. The Earl of Warwick himself called out across the field that, quote, "No man should lay hand upon the king, nor on the common people, but only on the lords, knights, and squires," unquote. Thus, the rank and file of the royal army was spared, and hit squads moved around the battlefield, targeting and cutting down the royalist captains. The Battle of Northampton, if you want to call it that, only actually lasted about 30 minutes or so. And in the end, only about 300 men lay slain on the field, out of more than 10,000 who'd been marched and lined up to have the fight. But amongst those 300 were Buckingham, Beaumont, Shrewsbury, and Thomas Percy, all hunted out and killed where they stood. While the butchering of his lords were taking place, the king was captured in his tent, and as helpless in the field as he had been on the streets of St. Albans in 1455. He'd been captured again, and the Earl of Warwick had won an amazing victory. He was taken first to the nearby abbey, and then on to London, no longer a puppet of his wife, but now a prisoner of the Earl of Warwick and his allies. wore the Roses scorecard update, early July 1460 edition. Number of wars, 3. Number of times Henry VI has been captured, 2. Number of regimes, 6. Current regime, the Duke of York is nominally in charge as the Earl of Warwick holds a king and his supporters have scattered everywhere. The news of the Battle of Northampton arrived in London on the evening of the 10th of July. The siege continued, but the pro-royalists inside the castle must have been very nervous. We think, but do not know, that the indiscriminate firing of cannon from the tower and at the tower may have stopped around now, but it may have carried on. On the 16th of July, however, the Earl of Warwick and his fellow commanders came to join his father, the Earl of Salisbury, in the city. And the entire situation in England had now changed, because they now had the king under their protection. Yeah, that's the word we'll use. They were protecting him. And the king had to be placed somewhere nice. No, not his palace in Westminster. Westminster was a hotbed of the royalists. No, they wouldn't trust him staying there. Now, that's it. The location to host the king was decided to be the palace of the Bishop of London, right next door to St. Paul's, in the heart of the city. And above all, just down the lane and in easy eyesight of Warwick's London bastion, Baynard's Castle. Perfect. That way the Earl could be close to offer extra protection if the king needed it. Across on the other side of the city, the garrison in the Tower of London was now ready to surrender. They were running out of provisions, and more than that, they knew there would be no relief or reinforcements coming to their rescue. On the same day, the Yorkist earls entered London with the king. The guys in the tower opened negotiations for the surrender of it, and we have a record that day of a letter issued by the common council of the city to the nobles in the tower. Quote, "Be it remembered that we, William Heywin, Mayor of the City of London, and the aldermen and the commons of the same, agree us by this present to hold firm and stable, and to perform every point, in that in us shall be all such appointments touching the giving over the Tower of London by the Earl of Kendal, the Lord Scales, the Lord Lovell, the Lord Hungerford, and Sir Edward Hampton, and others now being within the same tower, and the receiving of the tower aforesaid by the Earl of Salisbury, to the king's use as be made by the same earl or his deputies on that one party. In witness whereof to this same present we have put our common seal, written in London aforesaid, the 16th day of July, the 38th year of the reign of Henry VI, unquote. So basically, we know on the 16th that a surrender negotiation had started. In London, under Mayor Heywin, and this is the document where we know that there was a mayor called Mayor Heywin, had agreed that they would oversee a peaceful transition. Still, it took 3 days to get the full surrender. We do not know exactly what arrangements were made, but it appears that Lord Scales and Hungerford were given safe conducts to leave the city, while the rest of the high-standing people mentioned in the Chronicle, including John Lovell, were to be arrested. There are reports that the grocer Thomas Brown, who had fought his way into the tower, either attempted a violent escape at this point, or there was a violent attempt at his arrest. But arrested he was. Brown and 5 others were condemned in London as traitors, and were hung, drawn and quartered at Tyburn on the 29th of July. Brown's widow had to pay a fine of £1,000 to redeem the forfeiture of all her husband's lands. So strict and harsh had the sentence been. Lord Hungerford had managed to leave the city unscathed. But Lord Scales was not so lucky. He knew of the Londoners' hatred to him because of what he'd been doing during the siege. And the story goes that he didn't trust the city to honour the safe conduct. So he attempted to escape from the Tower of London the evening before the formal surrender. It appears he intended to take a boat to go just down the river to Westminster and then jump off and claim sanctuary in Westminster Abbey, because they all knew London would not go against church sanctuary. But as he got onto the river, they say he was recognised by a woman who knew him, and she organised the wherrymen, the rivermen of London who plied the waters for a living, and who had recently been besieging that castle. From the details, we do think Scales got as far as his boat, but the rivermen of London surrounded it, perhaps giving chase, and then dragged him from it. Lord Scales was murdered by the Londoners, and his naked body, covered in numerous stab injuries, was dumped onto the steps of the Priory of St. Mary Overy, across the water from the tower itself. The siege was over. London was able to return back to normal, only it could not. And the proof of that lies in the condemnation and execution of Thomas Brown for treason. You see, let's get it right here. Brown had been fighting for a king who was still the undisputed ruler of the realm, even though he's a prisoner over in the home of the Bishop of London. So who was he a traitor to? Well, if not the crown, he was certainly a traitor to the Grocers' Company and to London. And his condemnation and the severity of Brown's sentence does suggest that London was as prone to the level of personal enmity we're seeing in the rest of the country. And I mean, you know, he had been part of a group who had supposedly dropped napalm on the houses of London. He was one of them. They could have been his neighbours, the people in the tower killing. Yeah, Thomas Brown, you're screwed, mate. With this new status quo in national politics, we see the Grocers' Company move quickly to send out just the right message. That September, Thomas Canning and John Young, the Path brothers, were appointed the joint aldermen of the Grocers' Company that September, shortly before the Duke of York actually arrived in London. Young, who was not yet an alderman in the city, was clearly added as a Yorkist counterweight to Canning, who, as we covered last episode, was the former mayor who was now seen as unreliable to the Yorkist cause. The Grocers' Company knew it was going to be asking some favours of the men in power, and he also knew they were more likely to receive a positive response to the favours if York's trusted followers were seen to be in charge. And the city seems to have taken the same view, because John Young was at last admitted as an alderman of the city that year. Meanwhile, the grocer, Richard Lee, was chosen that October to be the new mayor. But at the exact same time, over in Bristol, the London grocer and avowed Yorkist William Canning was made mayor over there. And in the most spectacular coup of all, the London grocer John Payne and his followers, who we mentioned last chapter, were able to invade Southampton's Guildhall at the mayor election with an armed mob and install forcibly a pro-Yorkist and pro-London mayoral candidate in there. Payne's ally and fellow London grocer John Walker was elected sheriff the following year and used his position to oppress the Italians and extract cheaper prices from them. And John Payne had one time been a trading partner of Mayor Richard Lee, and he undoubtedly relied on Lee's influence to gloss over the way he took power in Southampton, because he was a adherent of the Yorkist cause. So yeah, within London, the Yorkist members of the grocers didn't just take over the city, they were now extending their influence over to Bristol and Southampton. With the king safely in Warwick's keep, it now became fully safe for Richard, Duke of York, to return once again from Ireland, a journey that had been a bit too perilous early in the summer due to the royal control of Wales. York landed at Redbrook near Chester on or around the 8th of September. The Third Civil War, the invasion of England by Warwick and his forces, had seen the old regime change, and here was the Duke of York returning from exile in Ireland to head a new one. But instantly, something was different. The change seemed nothing more than symbolic at first. When the Duke of York met his wife in Abingdon that early October, he had instructed his wife to meet him enthroned upon a, quote, chair covered in blue velvet, unquote, drawn by four pairs of coursers. He himself arrived dressed in the livery of white and blue, neatly embroidered with fetterlocks, the D-shaped iron manacles used to tether horses by the leg. This symbol had first been associated with John of Gaunt, the direct ancestor of Henry VI, but had also been used by Edward of Norwich, Richard's uncle and the predecessor as Duke of York, and he'd died at Agincourt alongside Henry V. There was no mistaking the Plantagenet pedigree that the livery implied. Symbolically, the Duke of York was sending out a huge signal. Together, the Duke and Duchess travelled down to London, with trumpets blown before them the entire way. Banners displaying the arms of England caught the wind high above their regal procession. And to complete his amazing new look, York commanded his sword be borne upright before him. To the residents of our city of London, as they watched the Duke of York return again to the city he'd often come in supposed triumph in the past, there was no mistaking the symbolism of this return. York had returned from Ireland not to serve as a counsellor or protector of the crown. It seemed like he'd come back to England to become king. And everyone was kind of shocked. I mean, of course they were. The central tenet of the entire Yorkist cause after all these years, and indeed the central tenet of every bit of opposition to the king's regimes, had always been the proposition that those who surrounded the kings were the enemy and traitors. Indeed, everything that had been done in England since the death of Henry V had been done to preserve the power and the authority of Henry VI. Even if the king was a baby, or a very easily intimidated adolescent, or a naive and gullible young man, or as a drooling lunatic, or even now, as a defeated, traumatized, shell-shocked figure prematurely ready to be buried, everything was done and is being done and justified to maintain him in power. This is the first political principle of England. And I mean, even looking back on history, to depose or attempt to replace a king who was not being actively a tyrant, such as, you know, King John, Edward II, Richard II, wasn't just a wrong thing to do, it was utterly unthinkable. And Henry VI may have been a useless sock puppet, but he was no tyrant. And yet, here we are. After 15 years being the kingdom's pain in the ass, the Duke of York is wearing Plantagenet livery and sending out huge political signals. He was crossing the uncrossable line. But in truth, if you look at the situation, he kind of had no choice. On paper, the Duke of York had defeated everyone, and all the important principal leaders opposed to him, they were dead. Edmund, Duke of Somerset, Humphrey, Duke of Buckingham, the old Earl of Northumberland, the young Earl of Shrewsbury, Lord Beaumont, they're all dead, Dave. On paper, the leaders of the opposition were men like James, the Earl of Wiltshire, or Jasper Tudor, the Earl of Pembroke, and a few others, but they were minnows. But his true enemy, however, was still out there. Margaret of Anjou, Queen of England, champion not only of her now recaptured husband, but far more importantly, the champion of the seven-year-old Prince of Wales, Edward. As long as she existed, the Duke of York's position would never be secure. He could have control over as many powerful nobles as he wanted, but any regime he led would never know peace. Thus, this third war would carry on and carry on. The only solution for York was either to make himself king, or, as his cousin Henry V had done in France under the terms of the Treaty of Troyes in 1420, have himself designated the king's heir. Both options would disinherit Prince Edward, and thereby neuter the Queen. In terms of real politics, both these options made total sense. However, in terms of practical politics in England, this whole thing backfired, and the nature of these civil wars suddenly changed. The Duke of York seems to have been confident that, having been hearing himself proclaimed as the champion of the Commons of England and their preferred man to occupy the throne, he'd sweep into his new position to the sound of cheers and celebrations. At 10 o'clock in the morning on Friday the 10th of October, several hundred men on horseback rode down the street that would eventually be called Whitehall, escorting the Duke of York to the Palace of Westminster, where Parliament was then sitting. Upon entering the outer gate, York moved through the palace with his sword still borne before him and stormed through the great hall. He did not stop, he marched on, bursting into the Painted Chamber to find the Lords of Parliament assembled before an empty throne. Standing before his peers, as his servants held the cloth of state over his head, York, quote, gave them knowledge that he proposed not to lay down his sword, but to challenge his right, unquote. He was staking his claim to the crown. He was met with silence. Shock, pure, utter shock. York was the head of a faction that had just taken political control over England, for sure. The king was sitting down the road in London, in the bishop's house, under strict armed guard. None would fight that, but this... York retired to take up lodging in the Queen's chambers. She'd fled to Wales. He'd use her bed. Lovely symbolic FU to the French woman. But there was a sense of awful horror and shock about what York had done. You see, in doing this, he'd changed everything. Because previous to this, none of this fighting was about genealogy. Sure, we've been referring to the Yorkists, but that was shorthand to denote nobles and merchants allied to the cause of the Duke of York. A single man. This was politics. And the opposition was opposed to him for political reasons. York was to them a petulant pain in the ass. Ancestry had sod and all to do with any of the fights that had just been taking place. But now, the Duke of York was asked to submit his claim to the crown, which he did on the 16th of October, via his chancellor, his nephew George Neville, the Bishop of Exeter. Neville in turn presented to the Parliament a large genealogical roll of paper, which detailed the Duke of York's ascent from Henry III. No, York had not been harbouring resentment or ambition for the throne all his life, but this is what he had to do in order to justify what was in effect a coup d'etat to usurp the line of succession. It fell to Parliament to debate this matter. But ultimately, they weren't really debating this. The dynastic case was there to be made, but it was pure BS. Let's be brutal. What everyone there at the time knew, and what we can see now clearly centuries later as plain as day, if the Duke of York really acted out of conviction that his cause was purely a dynastic case of right and wrong, he would have staked his claim at some point previously during, I don't know, the last two decades. He'd never done so. He'd never mentioned it. And that was because what was really going on in 1460 was all this talk about dynasties was a veil for a practical argument about effective kingship. It was not the real reason that York claimed the throne. He was here because Henry VI was useless, Queen Margaret was a vicious tyrant, and Richard Plantagenet did have an ego. Everything he had tried to improve the state of government in the past had failed. So this was it. This was his final option. And this was a horrendous truth before Parliament, and there followed 2 weeks of debate. And then there in Westminster, next door to London, the residents would have seen the compromise solution to the issue. First of all, the myriad acts of the 1459 Parliament of Devils, which disinherited the Yorkists, were all legally rescinded. Secondly, it was agreed that the king would enjoy the crown for the rest of his natural life, however long that may be. And from now on, the Duke of York would be, quote, entitled, called and reputed from henceforth, very and rightful heir to the crowns, royal estate, dignity and lordship, unquote. Young, Prince Edward was duly abruptly replaced in the royal line, first by the Duke of York and then by his sons, the Earls of March and Rutland. This agreement was publicised on the 31st of October 1460, and it was bolstered by an incredibly effective Yorkist propaganda machine, which had that summer been energetically spreading rumours that Prince Edward was illegitimate and thus not even the king's son. War of the Roses scorecard, October 1460 edition. Number of wars, 3. Number of times Henry VI has been captured, 2. Number of regimes, 6. Current regime: Henry VI in charge in name, but Richard, Duke of York, named as his heir and running the state in all ways. And all seemed to be done. 3 wars. 3 vicious civil wars. But this could have been worse. But it was it. It was over. Peace in our time, right? Hell no. As Christmas approached in 1460, the Queen and her supporters found themselves scattered to the corners of the realm. At the end of November, while York sought to destroy her family's future in Westminster, Margaret was encamped at Harlech Castle with her brother-in-law Jasper, the Earl of Pembroke. To use a phrase of one chronicler of the time, it was clear to the whole kingdom that, quote, she was more wittier than the king, unquote, aka she had more brains, and she was having to use them and act with great cunning. She knew as long as she was in Wales, eventually the Duke of York would come for her. So she decided to risk the freezing Irish sea in order to escape from Wales. On a cold day in early November, the Queen placed herself and her son on a ship and headed north. They arrived in Scotland on the 3rd of December, and there she came under the protection of Mary of Guelders, the widow of the recently deceased King James II of Scotland, and the regent to her 9-year-old son, King James III. Yep, 2 queens with child kings under their protection. The two women found that they had much in common. Soon after Margaret reached there, she learned that her ally, Henry the Earl of Northumberland, had decided to raise an army in the north of England. And he was riding around, raiding all their enemies' estates, burning them to the ground, causing hell and confusion, and spreading rumours about the Duke of York and attempting to stir other people who they weren't burning into rebellion. Margaret quickly saw this was something she needed to support. From Scotland, she managed to contract her various supporters, Henry, Duke of Somerset, Thomas, Earl of Devon, and their capable military aide, William Hady, a veteran soldier of the West Country. But they were hundreds of miles to the south. Still, she instructed them somehow that winter to find their way by whatever means they could to get to Hull. The last war may have ended in their defeat, but now they would start a new war, an attempt to topple the regime of the Duke of York. Included in this gathering storm was Andrew Trollope, the treacherous Calais captain whose defection from the Yorkist side had resulted in the rout of the Battle of Ludford Bridge and who had battled against Warwick over in France. The Queen had showed she could play a strong propaganda game too. She wrote in the name of Prince Edward to the City of London. There the young prince denounced the Duke of York as a, quote, horrible and falsely forsworn traitor, mortal enemy to my lord, to my lady, and to us, unquote. And with a, quote, untrue pretense claim, unquote, to the crown. The letter seemed to have the young prince ask London citizens for, quote, aid to free King Henry from the Duke's malicious grasp, unquote. Oh, this was not good. 1460 had been an insane year for London. The siege of the Tower had caused great anger, and while the narrative of the Wars of the Roses dominates the history of the period, if we just step back for a second and look to London, we see its own story just as interesting. The Duke of York was in charge alongside the Earl of Warwick, and London could be assured that they would have benefits from these.
The pro-Yorkist faction of London's Grocers Company were delighted. And because of this, not only did they hold the mayoralty of London, but they also controlled the mayoralties of rival ports, Bristol and Southampton, providing consistent approaches against their Italian mercantile rivals. The Staplers, long an influential faction in London, and with their control of the Calais wool market, were rejoicing as their long-term future was assured, as the captain of Calais was part of the new regime. London was doing well from the Yorkists. And the residents, well, the way they saw it, it was the royalist side that fired indiscriminately upon innocent men, women, and children. It was the royalist side who dropped wildfire on the streets of London. London would remember this going forward. And I'm going to stop it there. Thanks for listening. This is Saul, hoping you enjoyed this episode. And I'll see you again for another chapter of this, The Story of London. Thanks. Bye.